In the 9 studies so far in this evening series, we have considered first the inevitability of suffering as a condition of human life and of the life of God's people in the world. Secondly, the various forms or types of affliction to which the Bible gives its attention. Third, the problem created by the fact, to which the Bible often avers, that it seems in this world as though the righteous suffer more than the wicked, and how the Bible addresses that problem. Fourth, the problem that so much and such terrible human suffering poses for theodicy, the justification of God's ways. How can a good and just God permit so much trouble, so much sorrow in the world which he has made and which he rules? We discuss both several popular but finally unhelpful resolutions of this problem, and then the Bible's own. And we especially pointed out from Ecclesiastes the absolute importance of recognizing the profound limitations of our understanding of God's ways. Read a very fine article today this week in a journal that came across my desk about the difference between a contemporary pastoral theology in which, whether these words are ever really spoken or not, the implication is always lurking near the surface that every problem can be fixed. Every problem in life has a solution. Every difficulty that people find weighing upon them can be explained and can be got past and got through. And this particular journal article was making the point that even unbelievers had a better grasp of the profound depth of human life and of human character, how in many ways it is past finding out, and how many things and so many things in our lives are and ever shall remain beyond our understanding, and so many things in life beyond our ability to change, and that a great deal of what is biblical spirituality is missed on account of this pastoral theology, because the notion of submission to God in the circumstances of our lives is not anywhere nearly as much emphasized as the Bible emphasizes it itself. Fifth, following upon a general statement of the Bible's justification of God and the sorrows of mankind, we began a more specific examination of the holy and righteous purposes which God fulfills in the troubles and sorrows and afflictions which he visits upon mankind, and especially upon his own children. God's purposes in our afflictions are just and righteous altogether, and we see that when we pay attention to what these purposes actually are, and how afflictions serve them and are necessary for those purposes to be served in our lives and in the world. And of those purposes which God has in the afflictions of mankind and in the afflictions of his people, we have so far considered afflictions as punishment for sin, as foretastes of both heaven and hell, by which our minds' concentration and preoccupation with this world is broken, and we are forced to think about the next world, which otherwise we never would. The use of afflictions in drawing sinners to Christ, in making them willing in the day of God's power to do what they would never otherwise have been willing to do. And then the purpose of God in our afflictions to sanctify us. And we pointed out that God uses afflictions in a variety of ways to sanctify, to purify his people, to make them godly. We considered the first of those ways last time. He uses affliction to teach, to educate, to instruct, to bring the teaching of his word to life in our minds and in our hearts. Tonight I want to consider another way in which our sanctification, our growth in holiness and Christ-likeness is served by the afflictions the Lord brings into our experience. And tonight I'm speaking of the effect that troubles have upon our pride, and the divine use of them to break our spirits and to humble us. There isn't any doubt, really, that pride is the great problem of human nature, and that true humility is, therefore, the bottom virtue or the foundation of all real godliness. The Bible's verdict upon men and women in their sinfulness is precisely that they have become lovers of themselves instead of God and of others. And this is a universal problem. In our day, this is, I think, increasingly misunderstood. We hear so much talk about people with poor or low or defective self-images that we can come to think, and indeed by many are encouraged to think, that while pride is a problem for some, say the Donald Trumps and Ted Turners of the world and the church, for many others, pride is not a problem at all. But quite the contrary, they suffer from a lack of pride, a too negative and critical view of themselves. Well, there is no doubt that people sometimes, in fact, large numbers of people, have poor self-images, and that this can be destructive, and there is no doubt that the Bible does teach us what constitutes a godly and healthy view of oneself. Though wisely, the Bible does not use the terminology, the very distracting and easily misunderstood and misused terminology of modern psychology. But it is important for us to recognize that a bad self-image, a low self-esteem, is just as much a matter of pride as is boastful self-confidence, self-assurance, and self-congratulation. It is simply another way that pride, flaming, ruling pride in the human heart, gives expression to itself in a personality. For the simple fact is that people with supposedly poor self-images share the same fundamental perspectives about themselves as do the vainglorious people who are always drawing attention to their own accomplishments. They feel that the sun rises and sets on them, which is why for them the world is so bleak, because they are unhappy, and they should be happy. People with what is now called low self-esteem are, many of you will have learned yourselves, some of the most self-absorbed people in the entire world. They are just as unwilling, I've discovered, to hear the real truth about themselves as are the successful proud. They are just as unwilling to make the stoops the Bible requires of one who would be saved by another's righteousness and another's grace and mercy. Even a preoccupation with their sins and with their sinfulness and with their failure is a form of pride, feeling as they do that their sins are greater than the sins of others, and too great for a mere heaven-sent Messiah to handle. Listen to the always amazingly perceptive C.S. Lewis on the pride that lurks behind low self-esteem. There are other profitable... This is, of course, the uncle Screwtape advising his nephew, Devil Wormwood. There are other profitable ways of fixing his attention on the virtue of humility. By this virtue, as by all the others, our enemy wants to turn the man's attention away from self to him and to man's neighbors. All the abjection and self-hatred are designed in the long run solely for this end. Unless they attain this, they do us little harm. And they may even do us good if they keep the man concerned with himself. And above all, if self-contempt can be made the starting point for contempt of other selves, and thus for gloom, cynicism, and cruelty. You must therefore conceal from the patient the true end of humility. Let him think of it not as self-forgetfulness, but as a certain kind of opinion, namely a low opinion, of his own talents and character. Some talents, I gather, he really has. Fix in his mind the idea that humility consists in trying to believe those talents to be less valuable than he believes them to be. No doubt they are, in fact, less valuable than he believes, but that is not the point. the great thing is to make him value an opinion for some quality other than the truth, thus introducing an element of dishonesty and make-believe into the heart of what otherwise threatens to become a virtue. By this method, thousands of humans have been brought to think that humility means pretty women trying to believe they are ugly and clever men trying to believe they are fools. And since what they are trying to believe may, in some cases, be manifest nonsense, they cannot succeed in believing it, and we have the chance of keeping their minds endlessly revolving on themselves in an effort to achieve the impossible. To anticipate the enemy's strategy, we must consider his aims. The enemy, this is extraordinarily wise and beautiful. Listen to this. The enemy wants to bring the man to a state of mind in which he could design the best cathedral in the world and know it to be the best and rejoice in the fact without being any more or less or otherwise glad at having done it than he would be if it had been done by another. The enemy wants him in the end to be so free from any bias in his own favor that he can rejoice in his own talents as frankly and gratefully as in his neighbor's talents, or in a sunrise, an elephant, or a waterfall. He wants each man in the long run to be able to recognize all creatures, even himself, as glorious and excellent things. He wants to kill their animal self-love as soon as possible, but it is his long-term policy, I fear, to restore to them a new kind of self-love, a charity and gratitude for all selves, including their own. When they have really learned to love their neighbors as themselves, they will be allowed to love themselves as their neighbors. For we must never forget what is the most repellent and inexplicable trait in our enemy. He really loves the hairless bipeds he has created and always gives back to them with his right hand what he has taken away with his left. Thank God for C.S. Lewis. He has enriched our century and Christian preaching wonderfully, though he was not a very good theologian in many respects. Humility is a great and a high thing. True humility is a very rare thing. You almost never come across it. It is almost entirely disappearing from our culture. It amazes me how it is disappearing from our culture. Mr. Hanula informs me that he discovered in teaching at the public high school that his students thought humility was a pejorative term. They could not distinguish between humility and humiliation. It was a bad thing. And how many of us watching television football yesterday saw one long day of young men preening before the crowds and the cameras with not the vaguest idea that this was really proud and vainglorious behavior, the kind of thing even unbelieving young men would have thought shameful not so long ago in our culture? I think we don't realize how rare and how splendid and how magnificent a thing humility, real humility, is, because so few of us have ever actually encountered it in flesh and blood, even in the Church of God. We can barely grasp what Richard Baxter meant when he wrote, "Oh, what a constant companion, what a tyrannical commander. What a sly, subtle, and insinuating enemy is this sin of pride." I read from you last week from Henry Scougal's magnificent little work, The Life of God and the Soul of Man, in which this very thoughtful and observant Christian was coming to terms with the fact that virtually nothing he did in his life, even the best and most holy things he did in his life, were without pride in their motivation and their impulse. We throw around the word and the idea of humility as if it were an easy and a small thing, when we have little idea of how hard it has been and what pains have been taken by the godliest people who have ever lived in this world not to think more highly of themselves than they ought to think, as Paul put it, to clothe themselves with humility, as Peter put it, or to walk humbly with God, as Micah put it. When we read in James 4:6 that God resists the proud but gives grace to the humble, or when we read in Isaiah 57:15 that God dwells in a high and holy place, but also with the one who is contrite and lowly in heart, we far too easily think that those texts are speaking about us. We do not see ourselves with the honesty and the clarity very godly people have always seen themselves with, and so we don't readily admit to ourselves or reckon with the fact that it could be said of us. What Shakespeare has said of Henry VIII in his play, "But I can see his pride peep through every part of him." It's not a difficult thing to prove. Actually, it's a very easy thing to prove that we Christians, are still the slaves of a pride ruling in our hearts, of self-love and self-worship and self-service which are beyond our knowing, and so deeply and profoundly rooted in our characters, in our feelings about ourselves and others, as to be virtually indistinguishable from ourselves and our lives. Our pride is revealed in the way we consider other people and judge them and value them and think about them so completely, so often in terms of their importance to us. Our pride is more profoundly revealed in the way in which 1,000 times a day and in 1,000 ways and so unconsciously we think about God in relation to us instead of ourselves in relation to God. And we are so little moved and stirred and preoccupied either by the grand excellency of His being or by the tremendous works that He has performed to save us. We sang, "Why was I made to hear Thy voice and enter while there's room, when thousands make a wretched choice and rather starve than come?" But if we're honest with ourselves, we admit that isn't a great question for us too often. We sang, "What language shall I borrow to thank Thee, dearest friend, for this Thy dying sorrow, Thy pity without end?" But most of the time, for us, any old language will do. We ought to be moved to tears of joy. We know it. We have sometimes been. And when we were, we knew that we were never thinking rightly or feeling rightly, more so in our lives than we were at that moment. But we don't ordinarily weep tears of joy for the grace of God lavished upon us. Our pride is often blatantly revealed to us, if only we would notice, in the resentment which rises within us when others criticize us, when others fail to notice us or appreciate us as we feel they should. We say that we are terrible sinners, deserving God's wrath and curse and the doom of everlasting death. But someone has the temerity to point out a minor fault, and we immediately resent it and wonder, how dare these people? Where do they get the temerity to accuse me? Filled with resentment and wounded feelings, our pride is revealed to us far too often in the fact that we have so little real sympathy for others. We find it so difficult, unusually impossible, really, to rejoice or really to weep with someone else, though we have no difficulty rejoicing or weeping with ourselves. That comes to us very easily. We occupy such a large place in the worship of our hearts that there's hardly room for anybody else. Still more do we see this in the positive displeasure we feel when someone else whom we consider a rival enjoys some success or some praise which we feel in some way lifts that person in relationship to ourselves. It takes more grace than I can tell to play the second fiddle well. Our pride is also revealed in many of our sins, which in one way or another are merely the expression of self-love, self-worship, self-congratulation in our hearts. Envy, jealousy, feeling that others have what we really ought to have. Judgmentalism, so much of this in all of our hearts. So quick to see the faults of others as if we had so few ourselves. Self-satisfaction. I remember reading an entry in Philip Henry, Matthew Henry's very godly father, his diary on his 33rd birthday. He pointed out to himself that by his 33rd birthday, Alexander had conquered the world. And he was still hardly beginning to conquer his own heart in the strength that the Lord provides. Acquisitiveness, temper, laziness, dishonesty. All of these have pride and self-love at their root, and many other sins beside. Now, it is this pride, the Bible is always telling us, which keeps Christians from being and becoming what they ought to be for Christ's sake, and for their own sake, and for others' sake, and for the world's sake. It keeps them from a life of devotion and love for God, because they are wrapped up in their own love for themselves. It keeps them from a life of loving others as much as themselves, and all the good and all the glory that would be given to God by and in such a life. It keeps them from the joy of free grace experienced in the heart for the proud man, and to the extent that you and I are still proud men and women, and that's a very great extent. To the extent that we are still proud, we do not think, we do not feel that God lavished His grace freely on us. We think, frankly, deep down, maybe at the subconscious level of our hearts, that it made sense for God to save us. That, of course, He saved us. Any God would save us. It keeps us from every form of true godliness and goodness. Indeed, as Pascal pointed out, without humility, every single one of our virtues is ipso facto a vice. Even Christ, who had no sin, was more humble than we are. He drew more humility out of His creatureliness than we're able to draw out of our sinfulness, massive as it is. His Father in heaven, His mission in the world, His disciples, the needy all around Him, everyone was more important to Him than Himself. And everyone was served before Himself. Never in the history of the world was there a man with more right to think more of himself, or a man who thought less of himself than he did. But for a sinner like you and me, even a redeemed sinner like you and me, to put pride to death, even to put it to death in the strength of the Lord, in the power of His Spirit, is the hard and the bitter work of a lifetime. Our God has appointed it to be so. The truly godly have always found it to be so. I've told you before of St. Francis's technique of keeping himself humble. He had a monk who followed him around. And whenever someone would praise St. Francis for his virtue, or for a sermon he had preached, or some other thing he had done, an act of charity or something, whenever someone would compliment or praise St. Francis, this monk was appointed to whisper in Francis's ear all the real truth about himself and his pride and his lust and his dishonesty and his indifference to God and man. But Francis, humble a man as he no doubt was amongst Christian men, he had to do even more than that. You remember that his ministry, his life of ministry, began with the building of this little tiny church out in the woods, for which he scrounged all of his building materials, got actually the people who would become the beginnings of the Franciscan order, persuaded them to join him in this what seemed to be entirely quixotic effort. In fact, he got into trouble with his dad for borrowing a significant amount of the building products from his father's lumber yard, or the equivalent of it in those days. But here's Chesterton going on. The wretched youth relapses into rags and squalor and practically crawls away into the gutter. That is the spectacle that Francis must have presented to a very large number of his neighbors and friends. How he lived at all must have seemed to them dubious, but presumably he already begged for bread as he had begged for building materials. But he was always very careful to beg for the blackest or worst bread he could get, for the stalest crusts, or something rather less luxurious than the crumbs which the dogs eat and which fall from the rich man's table. Thus he probably fared worse than an ordinary beggar, for the beggar would eat the best he could get, while the saint ate the worst he could get. In plain fact, he was ready to live on refuse, and it was probably something much uglier as an experience than the refined simplicity which vegetarians and water drinkers would call the simple life. As he dealt with the question of food, so he apparently dealt with the question of clothing. He dealt with it, that is, upon the same principle of taking what he could get and not even the best of what he could get. According to one story, he changed clothes with a beggar, and he would doubtless have been content to change them with a scarecrow. And then we find St. Francis making a habit of apologizing to animals, to cats and dogs, humbling himself before these creatures of his God and Father. Well, you say, I don't need to do that to be humble. And perhaps you're right. But then you haven't yet clothed yourself with humility the way Francis finally did. So you don't really know, do you, what it will finally take. And the techniques and the steps and the way with themselves that others have had to use to force upon themselves those thoughts and those convictions and those realities which are the true expression of godly humility in the heart have been just as radical through the centuries, if not precisely the same, as those chosen by Francis. I think of the great French court preacher Jean Massillon and the way in which he refused, to the point of rudeness, to receive compliments for his magnificent sermons, and they were magnificent. On one occasion, when someone complimented him on his brilliant speaking, he curtly replied, "The devil has said the same things to me already, and more eloquently than you." Or think of Charles Simeon, the great Anglican churchman, reminding himself with notes. He had to write notes to himself, "Don't talk about yourself." The crest, the family crest of Francis Fenelon, "Ama nescire," love to be unknown. Well, I say, if pride is this deeply rooted in us, and if humility is that important to godliness and pride, and if it takes, by the application of the Christian heart and will, such strategies as these, we should be very little surprised to discover that God uses and must use afflictions and troubles and sorrows and pains in life to break this pride and to humble us. And so he does. 2 Corinthians chapter 12, verses 7 through 10. We're almost finished, not just beginning, so don't be concerned. To keep me from becoming conceited, verse 7, the Apostle Paul has described the remarkable privileges that were granted him, not least a vision in which he, in the body or in the soul, he cannot now say, he was carried up and actually given to see what was going on in heaven. Given to see it so really that he was not permitted to tell us what he saw. One of the most remarkable statements, I think, anywhere in the Bible. But then this follows. To keep me from becoming conceited because of these surpassingly great revelations, there was given me a thorn in my flesh, a messenger of Satan to torment me. 3 times I pleaded with the Lord to take it away from me, but he said to me, my grace is sufficient for you, for my power is made perfect in weakness. Therefore, this is Paul again, I will boast all the more gladly about my weaknesses, so that Christ's power may rest on me. That is why, for Christ's sake, I delight in weaknesses, in insults, in hardships, in persecutions, in difficulties. For when I am weak, then I am strong. God's favor in Paul's life could, and indeed, Paul says, would have become a snare, a fuel to his pride. And so to help him from that conceit, which would have spoiled and weakened his own Christian life and his ministry as an apostle, God compensated with an affliction. What it was, we do not know, though a vast amount of ink has been spilt in trying to answer the question. But whatever this problem was, it kept Paul painfully and constantly reminded of his creatureliness. He was a creature. There was a lot that he couldn't control in his life or escape from in his life. He was severely limited. His weakness, it tormented him. It was a great struggle for him and a great sorrow for him. He wouldn't have called it a thorn in the flesh if once he knew God had visited upon him, it didn't bother him anymore. It continued to bother him terribly. And he was unable to do anything about it. He was weak. And it reminded him of his constant need for divine help and support. Christ's strength in his weakness. In this affliction, painful as it was, Paul was kept in mind of the vast difference that separated him from God. That God was God and Paul wasn't. And in that state of mind, Paul continued both to love and honor God and to serve his neighbor. And he says that in that state of mind to which his afflictions brought him, he found a power and a success that he could not otherwise have enjoyed. Pride would have spoiled it and twisted it and ruined it, made it into something foul, not something pure and good. As John Newton put it, we are never more safe, never have more reason to expect the Lord's help than when we are most sensible that we can do nothing without him. And you and I obviously need troubles for exactly the same reason today, to remind us of our true and proper place, to keep that distance between ourselves and God fixed in mind, that distance upon which so much is based in the thinking of the Christian heart and the feeling of the Christian soul, to keep us looking to Christ instead of to ourselves, to keep us looking to what the Lord will do and the Lord must do instead of looking to ourselves, and to keep us mindful of our great need and our great weakness and the hopelessness that we could manage this life successfully if Christ did not intervene on our behalf. Pride is so strong an enemy and so pervasive and so insidious an enemy of our souls, the Scripture says that often it will be broken only on the rack and the wheel. We'll stop loving and trusting ourselves only when we are broken and shattered and forced to see ourselves finally for the weaklings and the good-for-nothings and the desperately needy people that we are. You know Anna Waring's lovely hymn 444, "Father, I know that all my life is portioned out for me." Another hymn from her has this verse: "Glory to Thee for strength withheld, for want and weakness shown, for fear that drives me to Thyself for what is most my own." But don't despair. It may be an extraordinarily painful lesson that all of us must be forced to learn all our lives long, and that afflictions alone will be adequate to teach us to many degrees. But once learned, and even in the learning, it will bring an exquisite pleasure of which the world is not worthy. Here is Henry Scougal again on the pleasure of humility. "The grace of humility is accompanied with a great deal of happiness and tranquility. The proud and arrogant person is a trouble to all that converse with him, but most of all unto himself. Everything is enough to vex him, but scarce anything sufficient to content and please him. He is ready to quarrel with everything that falls out, as if he himself were such a considerable person that God Almighty should do everything to gratify him, and all the creatures of heaven and earth should wait upon him and obey his will. The leaves of high trees shake with every blast of wind, and every breath, every evil word will disquiet and torment an arrogant man. But the humble person hath the advantage. When he is despised, he has the advantage that none can think more meanly of him than he does of himself, and therefore he's not troubled at the matter, but can easily bear those reproaches which wound the other to the quick. And withal, as he is less affected with injuries, so indeed he is less obnoxious unto them. Contention, which comes of pride, betrays a man into a thousand inconveniences, which those of a meek and lowly temper seldom meet with. True and genuine humility begets both a veneration and love among all wise and discerning persons, while pride defeats its own design and deprives a man of that honor it makes him pretend to. But as to the chief exercises of humility, are those which relate unto Almighty God, so these are accompanied with the greatest satisfaction and sweetness of all. It is impossible to express the great pleasure and delight which religious persons feel, truly religious persons, he means, feel in the lowest prostration of their souls before God, when having a deep sense of the divine majesty and glory, they sink, if I may so speak, to the bottom of their beings, and vanish and disappear into the presence of God by a serious and affectionate acknowledgement of their own nothingness and the shortness and imperfections of their attainments. When they understand the full sense and emphasis of the psalmist's exclamation, 'Lord, what is man?' and can utter it with the same affection. Never did any haughty and ambitious person receive the praises and applauses of men with so much pleasure as the humble and pious renounce them. Not unto us, O Lord, not unto us, but unto Thy name give glory. Amen."